Okay, so we'll get started. Last speaker for today is Daniel Rucker, Imperial College in London. We're going to hear about another way of doing segmentation through registration. And Daniel is an expert where I first knew of him in image registration, so I think we'll see a different perspective.
Okay, well, thanks very much for the invitation. It's great to be here. And thanks for sticking around so late in the afternoon with such a nice sunshine outside. Okay, so what I like first to do is probably acknowledge people who have really contributed to the work. I'm based in the Department of Computing at Imperial College, quite a lot of people working there. But we also work together with the Royal Brompton Hospital, which is part of Imperial College, which does a lot of cardiac MR. And they really pioneered some of the cardiac MR there. And the other thing, we also collaborate with Guy's Hospital, King's College, which is a group of Professor Rosari and Professor Derek Hill on cardiac image-guided interventions. But I will not talk that much about cardiac image-guided interventions, just mention it fairly briefly. So what I really would like to do is give you a brief introduction and really a background to image registration, because I appreciate some of you know quite a lot about registration, but there might be some of you who are not that familiar with it. And we heard about registration already in the previous two talks on computational anatomy, but also shape modeling and segmentation you can really think of as a kind of model to image registration. I'll talk about registration primarily for cardiac segmentation, but also then for motion modeling, which is really increasingly important, and then I'll show you some conclusions and what I think is the area which we need to work in the future on. So really, unfortunately, don't have a very good cardiac example for explaining what registration is, but I think you can get the idea quite nicely from this picture. You have here three different modalities, and what really the key is that these three different modalities show you very complementary information. And if you map all this information into a common coordinate system, you have much more information than you actually have in any other single modality. And of course, if you're doing, in this case, surgery planning, you now really have combined quite different sources of information. So that's really the most common definition of registration, where you actually fuse images from different modalities together. But there's no reason why you should only do this with different modalities. Okay. So really, what the concept of registration is actually you're trying to find a transformation T, which defines a spatial relationship between two coordinate systems, typically two images. And really what you want to do is you want to find corresponding points between your what I would call target and source images. And really the feature, the key is here this corresponding points, because I can find an arbitrary number of transformations between two images, but I really would like to have one which is anatomically or functional meaningful by mapping same anatomical points between the two images. And then depending on really what, if I want to implement such a system, I need to essentially choose two particular types of what I would call probably functional parameters. I need to define a similarity measure, which measures how similar my images are. I could use points, landmarks is very common, lines or surfaces. But what I'm going to use is I'm going to use intensities, because I don't need to do any pre-processing on the data that way. And then depending on the application, I choose my type of transformation. And people traditionally, where registration really originated in the brain, have chosen rigid transformations, because the brain is using the skull as a kind of rigid body assumption. You can actually model everything as rigid, but I'll focus more on the non-rigid component, because of course that's in cardiac imaging really crucial. Just to give you a brief background, that several types of registrations you can classify: intra-subject registration, where you're trying to register images of the same subject, but could be different modalities, or could even be same modality across time. You could try to basically bring different information into a common coordinate system, for example, MR and SPECT or MR and PET. But you can also try to compensate for motion, patient motion or organ motion, cardiac motion or respiratory motion. And then we can do inter-subject registration, which is basically something like segmentation, where I try to register different subjects and or models together, and I try to bring things into a standardized coordinate system, for example, and into a coordinate system of an atlas. And then finally, serial registration, where I try to monitor temporal changes, for example, within an examination, so I can look at cardiac motion as one application of serial registration, or between examinations, for example, a rest and stress study, which I also need to bring into the same coordinate system to actually compare the data sets. And then finally, this is not what I'm going to talk about, is image to physical space registration, where one coordinate system is an image, but the other coordinate system is a physical coordinate system of the patient. For example, if I want to plan a procedure like an RF ablation, or I want to navigate during an intervention, I need to essentially align my pre-operative data set with my patient. I can do that by using extrinsic markers, intrinsic markers, or intraoperative images. I just want to show you a quick example of how that image to physical space registration would look like. This is a system which we have worked with. It's an XMR system where you have here an MR scanner, and you have here an X-ray set, and the patient table slides from the MR system to the X-ray set, and you basically can then try to align the two imaging modalities in order to guide, for example, a catheter or something like that. And in order to do that, in this particular example, you can track, for example, the table, how the table is moving in and out, and you can also track the X-ray set using, for example, an optical tracking system. And if you do that, you then can take an X-ray image, you can take the MR image, and you can augment the X-ray image with the MR image, and really, for example, provide a quite basically a kind of augmented reality version of your X-ray set. And if you have biplanar X-ray, you can reconstruct, for example, a catheter path and superimpose it onto the anatomy. Okay. So what I really would like to do in the beginning is just very briefly talk about some basic concepts in registration. And really, what you should think of this is it's an optimization problem. I need to essentially, I define a cost function which tells me how good my images match, and I have a transformation, and I simply minimize the cost function as a function of my transformation parameters, and then I should be done. So it's, in theory, it's fairly simple. But I already need to make a decision, do I work with monomodality registration, multimodality registration? Because if I work with monomodalities, I can basically use as my cost function something like the sums of square differences between my images. This is basically very similar to optical flow, as already mentioned earlier, but I'm essentially assuming that the intensities between my two images are basically related by an identity relationship plus some Gaussian noise, for example. So if I want to relax this, I can do something like normalized cross-correlation, where I just make assumption of a linear relationship between the intensities. So what do I actually do when these two systems break down? And that happens quite often if you do multimodality registration. Well, probably a good way to explain this is to actually look at something which I would call a 2D histogram. Other people call it a co-occurrence matrix. What I'm basically doing is I'm plotting here along the x-axis intensities in one image, and along the y-axis intensities in the second image. If I take the same image twice and I plot this, I get basically a diagonal, so that's not particularly exciting. If I start to misregister the image only by 2 millimeters and I do the same thing again, you can already see this diagonal line starts to fade out and blur out. And the more I do this, the more it blurs out, because I'm basically not comparing like with like anymore. I'm comparing one tissue class with another tissue class, so I'm not getting a linear relationship. Well, the key thing is now this really works quite well also if you look at multimodality data sets. So for example, if I look at an MR image and a CT image, I now have a highly nonlinear relationship, not even a functional relationship, because if you give me a CT image, I cannot simulate the MR image from it, because the CT simply doesn't differentiate between certain tissue classes. So the CT, the MR is not a function of the CT or vice versa. But if I misregister the images, you can still see that this clustered feature space tends to fade out and gets less clustered. And if I do this with MR and PET, the same thing happens. So what I could do is I could try to measure the clusteredness of this feature space as a way of measuring registration. This is a quite good movie showing this you this for a CTMR image. This courtesy from Derek Hill. Really, which illustrates this quite nicely. Pretty much, this is I'm translating an MR image versus a CT image, and pretty much in the middle of the movie, the two images are well registered, where the feature space gets fairly clustered. So people have really thought about this quite long, quite hard, pretty much 10 years ago, and came up with two different one particular way of characterizing this feature space. And this characterization is often termed mutual information, where what you essentially do is you look at this feature space, at this two-dimensional histogram, as an entropy measure. You define the feature space as a probability distribution from which you can measure entropy, and you measure the entropy of this feature space, and if you then also measure the entropy of each of these images individually, you take the marginal entropies minus the joint entropy, is what's in information theory known as mutual information, and it basically describes how well I can predict one image by a second image, and that I can do best if the two images are perfectly aligned. And there's some variants of this. So this is a measure which is nowadays really quite often, well, for multimodality registration, probably a standard measure of using that. So the second thing, and we're going to use this quite extensively. The second thing I need to define is my transformation. And I just wanted to give you a quick example of how you can think about transformations, because it was used quite often before. Already we talked about spline transformations. If I have an object which looks like this cube, and I want to deform it into something, or a square, and I want to deform it into a circle, there's an easy way of thinking about this type of transformation. I can think of the transformation as a surface telling me the x displacement and the surface telling me the y displacement. So if you look at this particular example, the height of the surface here on the left side of the square is negative, which basically means I'm pushing this to the left side. On the right side, I have a positive value, so I'm pushing it to, I have a positive x displacement. If I do this in the y direction, I simply have a 90 degree rotation. So why is this useful? Well, if you think about how you can model surfaces, splines are, for example, really one of the most frequently used tools for modeling surfaces, and this is what we're going to use here. But the other thing is quite useful to think about that the curvature of this surface tells you about something about how much deformation you have actually implied. As long as I have a purely affine transformation, there is zero curvature of these planes. Basically have an affine transformation which leaves parallel lines parallel. So I can use the curvature of these surfaces as a constraint to minimize my deformation. So the way we do this, we actually first do a global registration followed by a local registration. So the global registration is, for example, a rigid or a fine one. And then we use something like this cubic, this tensor product of cubic B splines, where I basically have a mesh of control points, and I need to work out what is the optimal location of the control points given a particular set of images. This shows you just on a synthetic example what's really going on. I want to deform the sphere into a cube. I superimpose this freeform deformation, this regular mesh of control points, and then I move around these yellow dots as a function of mutual information, even though, of course, it's a binary image, so it's not particularly challenging. But you can see I can actually deform the image quite a lot. And the nice thing is the deformation is actually C2 continuous. So it's not only defined at the control points, but it's a smooth interpolation or approximation between the control points. Okay. So far I haven't shown you anything about cardiac images, but I'll come to that in a moment. But one of the things that's just interesting is you can impose soft constraints to make your deformation smooth, for example, by minimizing the curvature of these planes, which I showed you earlier. But the other thing which is quite interesting, I haven't seen this applied to cardiac imaging, so that's why I just put it up here, is that there are people now working on, for example, imposing hard constraints on your transformation, on your displacement. For example, there's a paper on volume preservation, which their application, I think, is breast imaging. But really, what you there do is you make sure that your Jacobian of your deformation, the determinant of this, is 1, so you don't change volume. And of course, if you know that's true, then this is a very sensible constraint to impose on your registration. And there are also mass preserving versions. So for example, you can incorporate knowledge about the fact that if you look at the cardiac system, that they have, you have very little volume change as a whole, of the whole cardiovascular system over time. So what are the challenges for cardiac image registration? Because this has been actually done for other parts of the body, especially for the brain, for a long time, and it's now fairly standard stuff. So the cardiac anatomy, compared to, for example, what if you talk to a neurologist, they say, the cardiac anatomy is very simple. You know, it's very simple shapes. There's nothing topologically changing. But of course, that's also a problem, because if you have few anatomical landmarks, you know, I don't quite know which point corresponds to which other point necessarily along a surface where I don't have any feature. The second thing, which is quite important, is cardiac anatomy is really a 4D structure. It changes over time, so I need to take this into account. And the other thing is really that cardiac image acquisition, MR image acquisition, even though it has really changed dramatically over the last couple of years, there's still quite a number of problems. And if you look, for example, at this data set showing you this short axis and long axis view, if you look at the planes themselves, they actually look really nice. But if you look, for example, in the through plane direction, so if I take my stack of short axis images and I stack them up, you can see a couple of things. First thing is really that the slices are very thick, so my data has very anisotropic resolution. And if I need to interpolate in my data, this can really cause quite a big problems. But the other thing which is quite important is also that, you know, your data can actually is typically acquired in breath folds. So if you don't hold your breath in the same position, then your data ends up to be inconsistent, which you can see here. So this is some reconstructed long axis view from short axis images, and you can clearly see that there is quite a lot of misregistration between the slices. If you then apply some motion correction algorithm, you can actually reconstruct. You get a less distorted version of this, but you might have actually missed some data. You haven't sampled your anatomy fully. So even though this looks better, you still haven't sampled your anatomy fully. And the other thing you can also see that is from one slice to another slice, I can actually have quite a lot of differences in the intensity. So registration for cardiac segmentation, well, there's a very naive way which we tried out initially and to actually see whether we can actually segment images using registration. And the idea is very simple, comes again from the brain imaging community. Is you take a template or an atlas, for example, a labeled MR image, and then you register this to another subject. And once I have actually registered it to another subject, I can apply the same transformation to my labels, and I end up with a propagated segmentation in my subject's coordinate system. So that's a basic idea. And that seems quite straightforward if you can actually compensate for the differences between the anatomies. And to some degree, that works. And if you then, of course, want to actually track the entire sequence, well, again, that's a registration problem. What I really would like to do is I want to, once I've segmented the first frame, I register to the second frame, and I propagate my images and my labels to the second frame, and so on. And people have actually shown that you can get quite good segmentations using that very simple approach. So if you do this on a sequence of data sets, you can actually get quite good-looking results. Now, one thing we found is that if you do the propagation between different time frames, that works really well, because of course the heart doesn't change dramatically between two time frames. But segmenting the first time frame is a problematic, and if you make an error in the first time frame, this approach will propagate your error right through the cardiac cycle. So if you have a good segmentation in the first time frame, this actually works really well. But if you fail in the first time frame, you really have problems. So one of the obvious things is that we have taken a single subject, and we assume that's a good atlas for my population. And that's, of course, everybody knows that this is not a very good approach. What I really would like to do is, I have quite a lot of variability of the cardiac anatomy across the subjects, but also within a subject across the cycle. So what I really would like to do is I want to develop a model of variability which I can use to help my segmentation, pretty much in the same way as Baudouin spoke about it. So So the first thing I'm going to talk about are so-called probabilistic models, where I really just actually work out what is the probability of a certain structure being at a certain position. And again, that has been used quite frequently in the brain. And then I'll just talk very briefly, because Valdo and I have talked quite a lot about it, about statistical models. But the key thing is, in order to model any variability, I need to bring my images into a common coordinate system to actually do this. And so the key problem I have here is I need to do a 4D registration, because the heart's really changing between two subjects, not only spatially, but also temporally. So I could have a 3D registration of my images will not work, because I have differences not only in their position parameters. So for example, when do I, what's my temporal sampling, how much delay I have from the R wave when I start to acquire data, but also the cardiac cycles will differ in their length, but also the properties within the cardiac cycle will differ. So the first question I need to ask myself is, what is an appropriate transformation model to relate to 4D image sequences? And there are a couple of choices you could make. The first one is a kind of very generic model. You basically have a 4D transformation. Your X component is a function of X, Y, Z, T. Your Y component is a function of X, Y, Z, T, and so on. So one of the things, if you think about this, this looks quite well. This can model everything, but it doesn't really do what you want. For example, it doesn't preserve temporal causality. What I could have is I could, a particular location in one time frame can map into two different positions in another time frame. So I could map something forwards and backwards in time in the same spatial coordinate system. So that's not a good way to do it. The second option sounds a bit more, to some extent, that has the same problem, but I now have made time only a function of, well, time is only a function of t, so not any more spatial position. But I basically imply that I have a different spatial anatomy at different time points. The third option is much simpler. I'm just assuming that x, my spatial position is a function of x, y, z, and my temporal position is a function of t only, which basically implies I have a spatial registration which is fixed in time. So what I can do is I can essentially, if I adopt this, and this is what we have done, you come up with a decoupled transformation model. You have a spatial transformation, only a function of x, y, z, and you have a temporal transformation, function of t only. And then again, this I can model with rigid transformations plus splines, for example, to do non-rigid deformations. And again, this I can model with a linear transformation plus some non-linearities, for example, using splines again. And again, we use B-splines to model this temporal transformation. So the only other thing I need to do is I need to calculate my similarity measure over two 4D image sequences. And this is some results which you get if you do this. So what I've shown you here on the top is doing essentially performing a 3D registration where I've basically assumed that the start and the end of the cardiac cycle in two image sequences match exactly. So the yellow contours which you see here come from one subject, and I've superimposed them on the MR image of another subject. And what you can see here is that the spatial registration in some frames is quite good, but in some other frames it's actually not very good, because the heart's contracting in a different way. Because of course, I've just assumed that the first frame in my cardiac image sequence corresponds to the first frame in the other image, and so on. So if I do this 4D registration, I actually now also allow a temporal deformation to take place. I can actually get a much better alignment with a single spatial transformation and a single temporal transformation, and you get essentially a more consistent alignment of your data. So once you have done this, you can then, you have got your registration, you can build shape models, for example, 4D shape models, and what we really do here, we basically use the same idea as Baudouin. The only thing is we're now having 4D shape, we have for every time point we have a shape, and we want to put this all into a single piece, well, we could put it all in a single PCA, so I have NF is my number of time frames per subject, NP is the number of subjects I have. I can put this into a big covariance matrix. Or the alternative is I try to separate the within within subject shape variability by taking out for every subject a mean shape and the across subject variability. So what I basically now have is I have a shape model which tells me how the heart's contracting, and a shape model how the heart's varying across a population. So this is what you see when you do this. These are the first modes of the cross subject variability. So these are essentially modes of variation across my population, and these are modes of variation within a subject across time. And what you see is you see it more clearly if you look at the myocardium as one structure, you see here quite clearly this type of typical contracting behavior of the heart. And here in the cross subject variation, you see something which looks very much like what Baudouin showed you. And once you have this, you can actually use this for an active appearance model or active shape model for fitting. So the other approach we have been working on for segmentation is to actually try to do tissue classification. And you can very easily see if you try to do this, it wouldn't work for a number of different reasons. Because if I look at my blood pool, I get a particular intensity or distribution for my intensity, but I can't differentiate between left and right ventricle just by looking at intensity. That's clearly obvious. Similarly, it's very difficult to differentiate between myocardium and background. The tissue properties are very, not exactly similar, but they're quite similar. So if you want to use something like a expectation maximization tissue classification algorithm, it would fail pretty miserably, where you basically, what the idea here is, you come out, you have a parametric model of your intensity distributions, you then estimate, you classify your image using that, you re-estimate your parameters, for example, in this case, Gaussians, and then you repeat the procedure. So this expectation maximization in the brain really works quite well, predominantly because you have an atlas which tells you what is the prior probability of a particular structure appearing at a particular location. So what we decided to do is we try to build such an atlas for the heart where I take a lot of manually segmented hearts, I do spatial and temporal alignment, in this case only affine spatial and temporal alignment, and then basically I generate some probability maps which tell me what is the likelihood of a certain tissue being present there. And what you end up with is, you need to of course do this across time because the heart's very spatially across time. So this is, for example, a probability map for the left ventricle, where you can see quite clearly the reduced probability of the papillary muscles, and everything where you have very large values, it tells you you have a very high probability of being left ventricle. For the myocardium, it looks pretty similar. You see again, depending on whether you have a definition which includes the papillary muscles or not, you get some higher probabilities here, and the similar for the right ventricle. You can also render this in 3D, so these are volume renderings of probability maps. I'll just show you, for example, a top view here of the myocardium probability map, and you can generate these probability maps. So if you then want to actually segment a new image, what you need to do is you need to take your individual image which you want to segment. You need to register to your atlas, your probability maps. Then you can perform, for example, initial segmentation using tissue classification and a prior term in your tissue classification. You get some segmentation, and then you can iterate, for example, your EM algorithm. And what we have done is we also added some Markov random field to generate some smoothness or some basically include some contextual information and also a largest connected component to eliminate some errors. And if you do this, you can actually get fairly good segmentations compared to a manual segmentation, and you actually can now use an EM type approach to classify your image intensities and segment your image. So this basically shows you, top row shows you the segmentation results I get if I use only a temporal Markov random field. Next row shows you essentially what results I get if I use also a largest connected component, which basically is the idea of sometimes I have very bright structures close to the blood pool, which are, for example, arteries, which could be misclassified as blood pool, but if I use this largest connected component, I can actually get rid of them and remove them. Yes.
Can you comment on how an automatic segmentation is compared with the manual? What is the metric for assessing the quality?
So this is volume in this particular case. The other, there are a couple of metrics you can do. You can look at distances between the surfaces or contours, or you can use overlap measures to look at overlaps, how two segmentations overlap, a manual segmentation plus plus an automatic segmentation. In this particular case, I'm comparing here volume estimated by a manual segmentation with more volume estimated by an automatic segmentation.
Okay.
So really, in the second part, what I would like to do is talk bit more about using registration for motion modeling. And really, I talk quite predominantly about cardiac motion, but also a bit about respiratory motion, because that actually also in the context of image acquisition now becomes more and more interesting to work on. So you've seen these images before. If I want to do motion tracking, well, one of the typical problems you have is that it's very difficult to see the rotation of the myocardium, or twisting of the myocardium in untagged images. So we've seen this now a couple of times. You can acquire basically the same type of data with tagging, and you can actually now see much better what's going on inside the muscle, because you have the tag lines act as essentially landmarks, artificial landmarks, which you have embedded in the tissue. Of course, they're not really 3D landmarks, because as was said earlier, I only have information along the normal direction. I don't really know how I could slide along the tag plane, for example. So there is quite a lot of work on this. We saw quite a lot about this. So there are quite a number of different approaches how you can analyze a snake's optical flow, and there have been various attempts of using, for example, modifying optical flow to compensate for the fact that your intensity doesn't stay constant, which is normally an assumption. Can do HARP or you can use Garbo filters. So there's quite a variety. And as you probably have guessed, what I'm going to do is use registration to do this. Because one of the nice things about using registration is that in principle you don't really need to make any assumptions about what tag pattern you have. Or what you basically have a similarity measure that tells you how similar your images are at registration. It doesn't really know anything about what's in the image. So what I'm going to use here is a single freeform deformation. So I've put my regular grid of control points on this. These control points have nothing to do with tag intersections. Yeah? They're just a regular spacing of my space. And then what I need to do in order to get a fully correct motion estimation, I cannot register a single 2D image, or I can register a stack of 2D images. I need to really register at the same time short axis and long axis images in the first time frame, which is my reference. So what I'm doing here is really I register with a single freeform deformation, both the long axis and the short axis, and they have to agree on a deformation. I'm using mutual information to measure this, because one of the things you can see very clearly is the fading of the tag lines. So your constant intensity assumption definitely does not hold for tagged images. And if you think back to your 2D histogram, well, essentially, you would get, if you look at a tagged image, initially, the first frames, you probably get a distribution along the diagonal, but as the tags fade, you essentially get the tags form a cluster which is outside, which is not along the diagonal in your feature space. What mutual information does, it doesn't force this cluster to move here, it just tries to make this as clustered as possible. Okay. So there are a couple of And if I do this in a sequence, I can actually, I can basically add the deformations together in a sum of freeform deformations. But there are a couple of things I need to actually do in order to make this work. Because unfortunately, these are really implementational problems, not so much methodology problems. But what we need to do is we need to register the short axis and long axis images together. Now, I know the relationship of my long axis images and my short axis images using the information I have, for example, in the DICOM header. as long as I'm assuming that the breath holds are consistent. But if I, for example, need to interpolate in my data set, I now have a problem. How do I interpolate in a data set which has this irregular sampling? And for example, I cannot interpolate from my short axis images. If I move a through plane motion, I cannot interpolate and go in my long axis images because essentially they have a different tag pattern. So I can't do that type of interpolation. So the common way of what we, for example, do is we interpolate separately in the short axis images and in the long axis images. And also our mutual information measure is we calculate the mutual information between the short axis images and the long axis images, and then they are weighted together essentially by the weighting factor is simply determined by how many voxels we have in the long axis images and how many voxels you have in the short axis images. So if you then put your short axis images and your long axis images at the same time together, you get a motion field which looks pretty much like this. So the only complication which we normally have is that at least our clinicians tend to actually, they're quite hard to convince to actually acquire enough long axis images, because they typically think, oh, I take two orthogonal long axis images, it should be enough for getting your long axis motion. But in our experience, actually, that is not enough to actually do this. And also, depending on which clinician we have, they use either parallel long axis images or they use radial sampling or whatever they prefer. And of course, if I have radial sampling, then I can interpolate. But if I have completely arbitrary sampling, I can't interpolate in my long axis images at all. So this is basically a typical acquisition which you get. You get different short axis views at different levels of the left ventricle covering apex to base, and you get some long axis images. And as Dimitri already said earlier, I have to some extent visualization here of the registration is quite easy, because what I can do is I can take my transformation and I can take a tag grid which corresponds to the. This is basically a virtual tag grid. I know the position of the tag lines in the first image because their mask scanner tells me where I put the tag lines in. So I can actually then take the tag lines, I can deform them by this 4D motion model which I have. And I can deform them in any particular direction which I like. For example, I show here the short axis component of the deformation and here the long axis component of the deformation. But these are essentially, first of all, the red grids are not the control point grids. And also, I'm not doing a sequence of 2D motion trackings and then trying to put things together. I have a single 3D motion, single 3D freeform deformation. OK, and if I do that, you know, I can also visualize this by a tag plane, which I can embed in my volume. And I can see, for example, I'm visualizing always the same freeform deformation. So you can see that it actually looks quite consistent in all the imaging planes which I have acquired, which is of course really what I want to have. Okay. So we've done some evaluated it on real data, but also on some simulated data. And this is, for example, some images from a motion simulator, which is now quite old, but it's a quite nice way of simulating not only deformation but also the tag fading, and then you can simulate different planes, and then you can calculate what is your thing on the left side. This is a true strain as calculated from the motion simulator, and this is the strain calculated from your B spline, which basically the other nice thing is, of course, your B spline gives you a C2 continuous model of the deformation, so you can evaluate your derivatives and look at the strain, and you see they broadly agree, but they're even on a simulated data set, the strain that you can see some differences in the strain, even though by eye we've looked at this many times, you can't see any. The displacements look perfect, because essentially you're looking at very small very small inaccuracies in your displacement can actually produce quite large changes in the strain.
Was that a noiseless?
No, there is some. It looks almost noiseless, but there's some noise, and you can do this simulation for different levels of noise. And but it, one of the issues is really, I think, where if you look, for example, at the strain tensors, where they go wrong most, it's pretty much at the inside of this ring here in this simulation. And one of the reasons for this is you basically need to know what type of boundary conditions you or how you actually extrapolate your deformation. And in real cardiac MR, the problem you have is you actually don't quite know whether you made this boundary exactly right. So if you actually slide, because in the registration I'm using all the information, I'm not only tracking the taglines, I'm using everything. So that what is basically what we found in practice is probably the biggest problem with this, that if you slightly missegment, you're even by a voxel, you have potentially problems.
Yes. Can I throw in a comment or just a thought? Because I was going to talk about it a little bit tomorrow, but it might be of interest, it might spark some discussion. I mean, so the tag things are marking, Dan, control points in a Euclidean-based model. And so this is an interesting point versus the Lagrangian models of the material modeling and the finite element stuff. And, I mean, it would be interesting if that was it, but it could be that. It's holding it to, to the spline grid if some of the points are outside of the thing.
Exactly.
And it's in relationship to that.
Yes.
So, I mean,
that's one of the things we also thought about. You know, it's probably the regular sampling. So what we thought is we should actually move away from this regular sampling.
Well, I think, Phil, and part of what Jim is suggesting is that your control points also extend that into the chest wall and down at the liver. And you have, it's real hard to slip in pericardial space so that things are not stuck there.
Yes.
And your control points really trying to bridge things that are very inconsistent motion pattern and getting one average on. So you're sort of dragging down the heart in a sense.
Yes.
By having something control point you start.
That's absolutely right. I mean, at the moment, this is a problem of a spline-based formulation, as you have a C2 continuous deformation field, and that as you said, you can't have slip, you can't have inconsistent or discontinuities in there. So what we show some examples of this later. We try we've done some work of trying to move away from this, but this is pretty much work in progress, which I'll show you in a second. So then we also try to do the manual tag track, to do some comparison on some in vivo data using a manual tag tracking as a gold standard. And once you have done this, you can then do your what has been shown many times. You can visualize radial motion, circumferential motion in bullseye plots. So we also tested this because one of the applications we have coming back to this XMR system is that we have a cardiologist who's really interested in RF ablation of abnormal pathways. And so what he is interested in is how does it actually affect the motion pattern, this ablation. So what this shows you, for example, this is circumferential motion in a patient in this XMR system, pre-ablation, which is a shallow curve, and post-ablation in the same subject. So if you have done the registration correctly, used the motion extraction, which I showed you then, you can then actually compare the motion patterns before and after intervention. And so what we also did is also we wanted to see actually, they look quite different, but I've been, for example, in an MR system many times, different manufacturers, and the images always look slightly different. So we wanted to know can you do this consistently or not? And so we, for example, acquire data from the same subject three times, twice, and basically repeat acquisition, but the subject left the scanner between the two acquisitions. So it's not just lying there and you scan the subject twice. So also different breath holds involved. And then we did a very crude way of stressing the subject by basically putting the feet in ice, a bucket of ice water. And see what does this, because the subject wasn't really willing to do any other forms of stress. So, but you can see that you can, for example, detect differences in the motion patterns which come from these sort of donations. Okay. So really, and then the idea was, one of the problems we had is our motion models, we have a regular sampling of our control points. So this is not very realistic because I know the heart has a particular geometry, so why should I not adapt my freeform deformation to that geometry? And our first assumption was to actually use this kind of cylindrical freeform deformation, where you transform your data into a cylindrical coordinate system, and you have your control points organized cylindrically, and then you do your motion tracking. So one of the ideas was to reduce the degrees of freedom by ignoring the things which are irrelevant. This didn't work particularly well, and one of the systems is, of course, the heart's not really cylindrical, but also the problem is, if you have this kind of, if you require a freeform deformation with a regular topology, then you can't do, for example, planispheric coordinate systems or prolate coordinate systems where you have singularities. Topologically, it's not that straightforward to do. So basically, you can have that type of arrangement where you have this regular control point grid. You can ignore control points which are outside the myocardium because you're using cubic B splines. So if you know about cubic B splines, every point in your image coordinate system is only affected by the four nearest control points in every direction because it's a cubic spline. So you can basically ignore quite a lot of control points. If you do a free cylindrical one, then you have a different type of organization. So, but what we're currently trying to do is actually to do a B spline freeform deformation with arbitrary topology. And the idea is really very simple because the graphics community has done this, which has also invented MFDs. They have done this for a long time. And the basic idea here is to use subdivision algorithms. And if you know a bit about subdivision algorithms, the simplest way to explain it is actually to use this type of subdivision curves, which are the 1D equivalent. And the original algorithm was, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce its name, but it's basically called the corner cutting algorithm, because what you basically do is you take a control point polygon and then you cut away the corners of it by inserting new vertices in your coordinate system. So if you do this in the first iteration, you remove this vertex, you insert two new vertices, and you do this for every vertex. Then you repeat the process recursively, and if you do this a couple of times, you get a fairly smooth looking curve. And if you do it, you can actually show that in the limit, this approaches, if you do the right subdivision, approaches a cubic B spline curve. And if you would do this with a surface, it would approach a cubic B spline surface. So our idea was to take the topology, arbitrary topology, to actually do it with volumes rather than surfaces or curves. And this has been proposed not that recently, 10 years ago, by McCracken and Joy. And basically what you do is you start off with an initial lattice and you recursively refine it to generate a sequence of lattices which converge to a volume. But the big thing is that, you would generate a cubic B spline deformation. But you can do this with arbitrary topology. So just want to show you a couple of examples. If I would start off with this, these two cubes, one inside the other cube, but I'm now assuming that the cells are volumetric cells. Yeah? So these are not two surfaces, but these are volumetric cells. If I would subdivide this once, I get a structure which looks like this. If I subdivide it a couple of times, I get something which looks like essentially two concentric spheres which are meshed together. So the idea is really that I'm doing this now registration using using a base lattice, and then I choose a number of subdivision levels. Basically what I need to do is I need to get a subdivision so that for every voxel I get a displacement. And I know that the displacement which I'm going to approximate is that of a cubic B-spline. And then I deform my base lattice. So what I really need to do is, if I want to deform this, I only deform those control points no matter how many times I've subdivided my mesh. Yeah? So the idea is I generate this type of mesh, and using these control points, if I subdivide this quite a lot of time, I get this very fine volumetric cells. So this has nothing to do with finite element models. So this is really just a visualizer or a computer graphics technique for modeling displacements. So, but the big thing is I don't need to actually optimize the location of these individual cell vertices, but only those of the red vertices shown here. So I can then do the motion tracking, and what we're doing now is, for example, using only 80 control points, which is, I think before that we had 500, 600 control points. And so you only have 240 degrees of freedom for your optimization. These are some examples. So this is base latitude deformed. And of course, this doesn't really look particularly like a heart. But if you subdivide it a couple of times, you actually see that you actually really have generated some fairly smooth-looking deformation. Well, it's definitely smooth, but it also looks quite sensible, even though you have only really, what you have done is you have only optimized this particular lattice. And if you look at it from you can look at it from different directions, and you can also look at how the original lattice compares to the deformed lattice. So what we have done really here is just basically use a different transformation model and used exactly a registration approach. So I'm not tracking any tags, I'm just applying this to the image data. So what we really though also would like to do is actually work out whether we can actually, how much we actually need tagging. Because essentially our clinicians, they always do untagged MR because they want to look at the anatomy and estimate volumes. And then you have to convince them to actually do tagging afterwards. So the question is, if you try to estimate motion, wall motion from the untagged images, how big is your error which you make? And this is just showing you one example, because if I now do registration, I can register untagged images or I can register tagged images. And if I register these untagged images over time, this is a virtual tag grid which I can superimpose. And notice that it really does something which is not important inside the blood pool, because it registers blood flow, which is not very meaningful. But if I superimpose it on the tagged image, it sort of looks all right. It doesn't, it's the tagged image is basically quite in the same position as the untagged image. So ideally, they should be perfectly registered if you assume, they're two different breath holds. So the idea is now, can you put a motion model in this, for example, to actually help you, for example, recover some of the motion which you can't recover just by using this dumb approach? And so this is something we're currently still working on by doing essentially statistical models of motion. And this is just actually still doing the, without using the statistical models of motion, just showing you the deformation field you derived from a tagged image and from an untagged image. They look pretty similar, but if you look actually at the strain patterns, they can be quite different. So again, this is actually, we initially think this looks quite good. And if you look then at the strain, you're quite surprised. So the last thing I want to briefly mention is respiratory motion correction, because this is getting quite important. I mean, cardiac deformation, and that was shown again earlier, is caused not only by contraction, but also by respiratory motion. And you saw the movie from Baudouin. You can prevent this by doing gating, respiratory gating, but then you're doing cardiac gating plus respiratory gating, so that really makes the exposition very long. And you need respiratory motion correction for doing perfusion studies or for doing high-resolution imaging. So there are a couple of people who have used registration to actually work out a respiratory motion by doing exactly the same thing. You for example, look at maximum inhale versus maximum exhale, and you can perform registrations, rigid registration, for example. You see a reasonably good alignment, but you also see that there's some non-rigid deformation. And so the idea is that if you, for example, can actually look at the chest wall, you can actually guess where the heart is and what type of deformation you might have in the heart. And I'll show you an example just at the end, briefly. But really, what are my conclusions? Well, you can use registration in a number of different applications in cardiac imaging. You can do registration by constructing shape models automatically without doing segmentation. So Baudouin said earlier, it doesn't make a big difference. And I agree with him completely. The only advantage possibly of using registration is you don't need to segment your images, because you can register your gray level MR images directly together to build a shape model by learning the deformations. You can use atlas-based segmentation. You can do motion tracking of both respiratory motion and of cardiac motion. The thing I haven't talked about at all is multimodal fusion, which is of course probably where registration originally came from. And for example, there are a number of different applications. MR and ultrasound are, for example, quite interesting, particularly, for example, also for image-guided interventions. So the last thing I really want to just think is what will happen in the future, or what should happen in the future is, well, we already heard a talk about computational anatomy, and I think that is where probably the field is probably moving towards, because if you use standardized coordinate systems and databases, it's much easier to build population models and models of disease. This has been done really in the brain for a long time, partly because it's standard. The image acquisition and brain imaging is much more standardized. So yeah, it's much easier to compare one image acquired on one subject with another one. But also people have actually made a bigger effort. There are a number of studies where people have actually traveled around from different clinical centers and being scanned to actually assess the reproducibility of brain imaging. And I'm not aware of whether that, for example, similarly has been done for cardiac. Then I think we probably make a big mistake by just focusing on the left ventricle and the right ventricle, because it's, for example, very difficult to work out where the valve plane is. If you actually know where the atria are and how they move over time, it's much easier to actually get everything right. So I think one should really focus a bit more on the entire cardiovascular system. And again, Badawan showed some examples from Philips where that really has happened. And diffusion transfer information can really be quite helpful in that. So the other big future application for registration is actually in building motion models for intelligent image acquisition. A lot of the now image acquisition sequences, like if you look at KT BLAST or things like that, they're not possible without actually learning something from the data. So they learn in various degrees. They learn some model of motion, a very rough model of motion or so on. But I think that there's a huge, the image acquisition actually can benefit quite a lot from this registration and motion models. And for example, this is an example of using surface registration in real time to build a shape model of a breathing motion in real time. So what you basically do is you collect for 5 seconds or 10 seconds, you collect surface information by using an optical system with structured light of the surface of a subject, and then you register all these images together, you build a motion model which tells you the breathing motion, and you can then try to use this breathing motion model to work out, for example, you can then use it with some other information, for example, to predict certain types of deformations which are occurring, and you can do that in real time. So I think there's quite a lot of scope here. I think that's probably I should finish here.